employees there.
By way of review, a little bit, are there still some questions in reference to the use of the ellipsis? I just know whether we finished all the phases of it, as set out on page 15 and 16 in your manual. Yes, sir, please. A comma or a semicolon, that type, not a period.
And then would that also apply to before? If there's ellipses, like you're leaving out the front part of the sentence and that section ends with a semicolon, you don't.
That's right. Yeah. Now, normally you don't have an ellipsis at the beginning of a sentence, at the beginning of a quote. At least you don't indicate it. The fact that you start out. With a small, with a lower case, indicates that this is actually not the beginning. But I suppose you were talking about when it happens to be in the body of the material. Then, of course, the same thing would be true to a certain extent. But no doubt you have, the previous one has a period. In other words, it has to be four. And then if you say, no date was, that could only be correct if you have to be sure that your period here indicates actually where the omission was. What I'm trying to say is that, well, let's finish this sentence. And this is the end of the sentence. Then, of course, there's no space between the two as a normal procedure. And then you get your four dots. And then you would start with a lower case. Well, the assumption would be that this is in the middle of a beginning of another sentence, maybe two, three, four, not paragraphs, never, but sentences beyond. Yes, sir.
What if you begin the sentence with a quotation, you're beginning with starting.
Well, it almost always has to introduce the quote with something with you. In other words, Johnson said, or as Luther argues. See, the same rule applies that you never start anything in the middle of a thought. You always, the sentence has to have a subject. I don't think you'll have a case.
I was thinking something like this. The introduction, the idea that you begin a sentence with, is a phrase from this man's.
Yeah,
idea.
I understand
that.
Yeah.
You're going to go on. Let's say.
But then that phrase would have.
Reformation.
So what?
Let's say he uses a phrase like a pre-Reformation. Period. This is just a phrase out of his idea. And then you go on to comment from there. Was the phrase he used, let's say, when he said, or when he did this or so?
Well, then you're already explaining it by the fact that you say a phrase. Then you start with a capital letter. Sure.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, because you're explaining it. And obviously, if it's a phrase, it's taken from out of the context. I mean, out of the grammatical context. I don't mean out of the logical. Yes, yeah, that would be, that's such a rare thing, though. That most of the time, you have to work around in order to get it that way.
It may be obvious, but after the last period, after the last period of the ellipsis, would you give full space?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because this is the deciding point here, whether you have a space here or here. There you're seeing, in effect, that this is a period for the sentence. And this is merely the type rule that after a period, you normally have a double space. It's not a period, but a part of the ellipsis. It looks like a period. So. Okay, anything else on this? I think we have enough here. Now that you know the general rule, I think the examples that are given on pages 15 and 16 will refresh your memory on it. Actually, I want to call attention to an error that I just saw now, and I suppose we didn't catch it on page 16, in that full quote on a Luther, where it says, "Thus I will for the nonce understand it." That comma should fall. One of those gremlins that finally get in there, no matter what happens, it's always in there. Say it. Is there another one in there? Faith grasps. No, there's no comma there. Oh, yeah. That was corrected. Yeah, but this one, that's what I mean, wasn't caught. Page 16.
Yes,
in that large quote, Luther argued so and so. There is no comma there. Because the commas, semicolons, all the secondary types, in other words, none at the end, like a period and a question mark, exclamation mark, these all drop. The ellipsis overrules them. Because it plays the part of a comma, in a sense. Okay? All right, yes, please.
When do you add the omission marks at the end of the sentence? Now, presumably, the period is going to take that to override that longer quotation and close quotes.
Well, you see, this indicates that the sentence continues.
You
shouldn't dissolve. Oh, yes. No, only if the sentence continues. That's right. Yeah. See, and in that case, the period is the one before the 14. Because otherwise you're doing a work of supererogation, because naturally there must be space afterwards. Now, while we're out of this, you notice the other one, when an entire paragraph is omitted. The ellipsis extends across the entire page, beginning 5 spaces from the left-hand column. Normally, this is not used. You try to avoid that by simply bringing in another introductory statement, like Luther further says. And you get away from now. Occasionally, you don't want to do that for whatever the reason may be, mostly stylistic. That's the only thing I can see. Then go ahead and put it across the page. But that gets to be, I think it's an unnecessary need for that type. But if that's the style seems to require it, or if your own likes, then that's the way you do it. Because you should an ellipsis should not go beyond. They should not omit paragraphs. And once in a while you see ellipses even skipping pages. And the mere fact that you say on the bottom pages 67 to 69 is not fair. And they say, well, I've covered it, but somewhere along the line I skipped 2 pages. Because no one knows where the 2 pages would be. And naturally, the more you omit, the greater is the risk of taking it out of context. And therefore, you should warn your reader that this is another part. All right, now getting back to what we really started from, we were talking about taking direct quotations on our cards, on our data cards. Again, I'd like to emphasize the fact that you must be exact, and these are some of the things that we are saying by these devices. We want to ensure we don't take it out of context. For your own satisfaction, I think it's often advisable that you paraphrase as much as possible, as I said last time. But certainly, if your quotation is extensive, please do not write on both sides of the card. This is one of the easiest way of losing it. And then it's very awkward later on when you are outlining. In fact, that almost should be a standard rule. You never write on both sides of any material with which you're working, simply because you may sometime forget to turn over and it's lost. Now,
What do you do when, when you have to go over one card? The device normally used is that you hinge it with a Scotch tape of some type and hinge it in such a way that the back is on top. This does not mean that this is the first card. This could be the second card back here. This gives you all the data, which I'll mention in a moment, and the continuation is up here. Or, well, that's the way it is. Now, why this way, of course, is you can either figure out if you got it in a file box. If you had it this way, you could hide a couple of notes in there and never find them until you pick this card out. So to avoid that, just a simple device, always have your bridge, so to speak, on top. Just a little thing that can avoid some annoyances. As far as the card itself is concerned, or paper, whatever you're using, you never write on this top line, if it's a rule. Well, most of you probably will be using cards that are not ruled. But in that case, remind yourself that you don't use this top line for your quotation. It has another function. And the moment you start your quotation, the first thing to do is to put the page reference. It's again one of these little devices. If you get into that habit, you won't forget it. When you're closing off the quotation, that you don't leave it without the page reference, and goodness knows how you'll ever find it again. If you cross the page line, you go to page 19, then put down page 19 at that spot, exactly, where you changed over. Putting it in brackets to remind yourself that you've added it. And again, I guess the reason should be obvious, that if later on you're only using this part of the quote, you know where the break was, then you won't put in your footnote pages 18 and 19 to the confusion of your reader, who will not find it on page 18. So that you know exactly where the break is, even if it's in the middle of a word, and you turn over. Then that's the only reason for this, although there's no profound rule behind it, but for your own, just to keep yourself from being annoyed unnecessarily. Then, down here, of course, and on every card, even when you hinge them, just in case that they separate again, and then that's disastrous if you don't know where the quote belongs, or while you are mending them, putting them together, use your own key device. Just the author, and if you only use one work by that author, that's all you need to do, and that's it. Or if you want to give if there are several by Smith, then use your own abbreviation to identify the title. Don't use, as some people suggest, a number which has its counter-reference on the bibliography card for Smith. That's all right when you're doing a term paper, where you only have 10 or 15 authors and it isn't too serious, because you can go through those quickly to find what 16 is. For the simple reason, while you're working with it, it's certainly no help to you after you got 100 or 150 cards. Your numbers are not going to be in chronological or in a normal order. 16 could be an S or it could be a B, and you have to be spending, again, a lot of time searching in your cards which one is number 16. I say that because maybe you've had term papers where this other device is suggested, and it's good for term papers. Because you soon memorize your 15 or 16 authors well enough, that's not going to be a gigantic trick. And then if you did forget what it was, I mean your quote, then 16, that's easily found. The next is your slug. And that is some key word which in one or two words indicates the topic. If this is dealing with the man's biography, you may simply put Vita in front, or biography, or something of this nature. Or if it deals with the phase that discusses is early days or whatever it may be. Give yourself this little slug as a help so that when you go through this, you don't have to read every card, where does this belong? And you may want to, in pencil, put over here, if that is after you've gone along a while, that you hope to, you expect to use this in chapter two. Although this may not be too wide if you're not yet aware of where it's going to go. Later on, when you write your very first draft, I almost should call it a pre-draft, one which never is shown to anybody, the one you simply are saying it, writing it as fast as you can while the ideas are with you. Don't worry about polishing it. It may sound very crude, it may even jump places. When that one comes and you are ready to quote, you don't write down, you'll say, Luther, as Luther said, and then, and you keep on going, which means this card, 96, will be looked up, and you don't put down a quotation again at this point, because if you spend time of correct or writing out the quote, that's got to be done precisely. You have unharnessed your thinking, so to speak, and the flow of thought has been lost. Yes, sir?
Just back on the rear of the card, do you have any other reasons why you think it's not a good idea to write on the back of a card besides the one you mentioned?
That it be a lost item?
Yes.
Well, the other one is the inconvenience. Now, I don't know how you operate, but most people operate by playing cards when they got their all their data out. They read it, and you put it in sort of a logical order. And you'll have to constantly turn around while you're looking these things up to find out whether there's anything more, whether it also belongs to another section. Because if you have put this card under chapter 2, paragraph 14, for instance, and there's a part of it that goes in chapter 3, which may be unusual, but it could, it doesn't particularly pertain at this point, or it's quite later, quite a bit later, then you may have predestined that note to that place and lose it completely. And it's just this business of turning them over that you should try to avoid. So at a glance, you can look at your notes, how this begins to form.
So it seems to me if you've made your note well, you're not going to have more than one central idea. In other words, I may have one central idea to take a paragraph and say.
How do you know it's central? This is the point. You may think it's central, but actually it may be putting a single idea, let's put it that way, rather than central.
Yeah.
A single idea, but later on you'll find that part of this idea is challenged. And you can't simply ignore it, you've got to expand on it a little bit. And this gets to be a later part of that chapter. These are the things you don't know ahead of time. You're correct, the principle, the theory, you wouldn't need to worry about that. And simply it extends it. But even then you'd have the difficulty of seeing at a glance what the note all says. And frankly, the cost of paper being what it is, this is the least important item in terms of your own, what are you saving?
Well, you're saving time. How do you get these two cards together?
Yeah, that takes, how long does that take? You don't have to do this with artistic beauty.
It takes a lot longer than it takes me to put my card over and keep on writing.
Yeah, they are granted you that. But it's just like a learning a hunt and peck, you know. It's much faster to do it this way at the beginning than to sit there and spend hours and hours learning how to type. But you have a ceiling. This is how fast you'll ever get. And now, this is true. Sometimes the time you save at the beginning grows in geometric proportion when you have to do the thing over and over again. Like the guy who says, well, why should I copy the whole bibliography? 50% of these books I'm never going to use. But he doesn't know which 50%. And therefore, he's got to go do this laborious task twice. It's this type of I wouldn't want to make a big issue of it, but take it or leave it. Yes, sir.
How do you decide the sequence of numbers on the right?
You do this as you lay them out on a card. That's right. You don't do this, the last step. This is, you do this when, after your outline, and, in fact, I followed prior to this. I make a very extensive outline, almost a sentence outline. That's not the first step. I mean, just ready to start writing. I got all my material. And then, as I've looked at the logical point here, assuming I have no gaps, well then, the cards will be kept in numerical order. Put that way. Now, it's never going to stay that way, because later on you want to do a little rearranging. And it's sure, you've got 115, 16, 117, 16 doesn't quite fit at that point, I see now. And it goes later on. But those will be rare, you see. And then what I used to do is that 96 would be all, assuming that you have about 100 cards for a chapter, this is arbitrary, then the 100 and so on is the second chapter and go on. Or you start out with 100, all the 100s are in the first chapter. But you'll have to determine that again, because you may have 500. You may, and the doctor thinks you may, well, 500 probably be too much, but you'll have 200 or 300 anyway. Well, then you use some other kind of device. One, use a 1,000 figure, which is pretty safe. No, they're not going to remain in that order. You'll find then, particularly when this thing that happened, which I meant before, this 96, you want to use later on again. And so that 96 is placed in that chapter again when you will use it. And of course, you don't want to, don't give it another number. These are merely labor-saving devices, that's all they are, also in the interest of accuracy. This might be, yes, especially if they are, if it's important that you don't get them out of line. Mm-hmm. Now, those are little devices that you, because especially when, and this happens in little sections of your thesis every once in a while, where there's only one source available, and or two sources, and you want to be sure that you don't lose the sequence of thought. And for that, use a little device. One, and that's all the more reason why you have to put this at the beginning so you don't confuse the page with the other reference. That's all I'd like to indicate about note taking, and take the next step as to the weighing the evidence. Yes, sir.
Not 18F, but
18.
No,
I mean in the body of the paper, in the body of the quote.
Oh, no. No, that's only the footnote.
Now, don't...
Now, wait a minute. Are you talking about in that very pre-draft?
No, on the final... No. Isn't sometimes you put a slash, or isn't it?
But, I don't know that fully.
If I have an extensive quote in the body of my paper, and half the quote is taken from one page and half from another,
no, it wouldn't be necessary. It wouldn't be anything wrong, but I think that, again, you'd have to put that slash in italics to not be confused in the where does it come from all of a sudden. Now, if you think it isn't important, you make another paragraph out of it. You see? And then you have two places where you can give the exact quotation. Now, in your own, it is important. That's why you could use the...
Obviously, nothing that you write will go beyond the evidence that you have collected. This is the this is all that can happen under the circumstances. And yet, it is also important to bear in mind that while this is true, it is equally true what you do with it. What you do with the evidence that you have collected. The validity of your hypothesis, which you are trying to prove, will rest on how you have weighed the evidence. And here you'll find that your hermeneutical rules, which are the rules for all sciences, as well as for hermeneutics, will prove most valuable. In general, let me just ask a few questions which I think you will want to ask and will not be equally relevant to all fields. Because of my historical orientation, I suppose most of my questions are more relevant to the historian, and I should say immediately to the systematician, because in this case they are related, rather than the exegete when he is doing the actual work. But when the exegete is beginning to summarize, then it's also true in that case. Number one, a very obvious one, is does the data meet the problem? You have set up a certain thesis in problem form or question form. You don't want to do what you find in a few questions in our catechism, that the questions ask one thing and the answer answers something else. So the data that you have collected, I should be the other way around, the data is the answer to the problem. Let me use a very crude example. If, for instance, your problem was, what is the program material which is being used, being produced by the Protestant Churches of America for Sunday school? And then you begin to use, go to the National Council, which is the largest group, of course, and study their material. Omitting at least two major church bodies which are not in that group. Or you are collecting the data which is officially produced by all Protestants on the assumption that everybody uses official material. And omit all the material that Moody puts out and the other Douglas and the dozens of other small publishers. And you still would not be answering the question, this is what the Protestant churches are using in their Sunday school material, and then begin to evaluate it. You've got one question, and you have the data. While it doesn't miss it, it doesn't coincide exactly. The next question, does the evidence give a hearing to all sides of the question? And here, particularly, we of a religious persuasion have to be sure that the material isn't so biased that we're only giving our own church body a hearing on a matter which crosses church denominational lines. I have here an interesting one, an example that Bruce quotes in his social, Hockett quotes. Here you have two outstanding historians, and notice how, on the basis of the material that they had, they come to almost opposite conclusions. Many of the most wealthy and influential houses in colonial Virginia were founded by men that could boast of no social prominence in England. Now an ellipsis. Adam Thoroughgood, although he came to Virginia as a servant or apprentice, became wealthy and powerful. So here was an exhibit A of a man who had no social prominence in England and nevertheless became wealthy. This is a quotation from Baker's Patrician and Plebeians in Virginia. Now, Bruce, in his Social Life in Virginia in the 17th century, writes, the different records show the continued emigration to Virginia of numerous persons who were connected by ties of blood or marriage with persons of high position in England. Adam Thoroughgood was the brother of Sir John Thoroughgood, who was attached to the court of England. Same person is mentioned on the basis of obvious evidence, because the other fellow said he came in as an indentured servant, and the other one indicates that he came out of a socially prominent country. One fact was omitted or forgotten, and I'm sure these people, or at least there's one person, Wurtenberger is the one that's making the mistake, in this particular case was caught really in the most embarrassing position.
because he forgot that the law of primogeniture. This fellow is the second or the third, as he says, was the brother of Sir John Thorogood. And you remember that it was the oldest son that inherited the title and the property. And the other one got a fond farewell. So when Thorogood left, he didn't have much money. And, as was very common, had his way paid and became an indentured servant. Once this was paid off, then all his previous breeding and education, which he got as a man of social prominence, came to the fore. He used this, and a new factory, you see, arises, simply because one piece of data was missing in the conclusion. Another question you must ask, do the factors of the experiment, for example, satisfy the conditions of the problem? Have all the variables been controlled or taken into account? Or are there enough cases to come to a conclusion? Is the situation a true one? And so forth. A couple of years ago, there was printed in one of our magazines an example of the religious attitudes or the religious knowledge of children attending Sunday school and parochial school. And a comparison was made. And the most important factor in teaching was omitted, namely the home. And so the values of the individual home were carried on into the picture. This was one mistake which Mr. Johnstone, in his recent little study, did not overlook. And he tried to screen out the home and make that a positive one. And as a result of that, much of the credit that we often give to successful religious educational institutions really belong to the home as much as, if not more so. Now, we always do this when the child gives us a lot of trouble. Well, he comes out of bad home conditions. He doesn't give us any trouble, parochial school or the Sunday school is doing a bang-up job. The home always gets the one side of the basket and always the bad end of it. And this particular study gave an outstanding picture to one of the agencies, which it really didn't deserve, in terms of the data. Here's another one that appeared more recently in Advance, which is interesting, where confirmands from large congregations, parochial schools, most stable. The person was interested to find out whether if you have children in large congregations and parochial schools, particularly, would these be more stable in the as future members, and the evidence is overwhelming. Now, this was contrary to what most people would have normally believed. When you think of 2,000-3,000 people in a congregation, you would normally expect that the church has less influence on the individual than in a congregation of 300 or 400 children, all other things being equal, because the pastor has more direct contact with each of the children. And so this was quite a startling discovery. And I won't give you all the data. Just mentioned this. Churches with communicant membership of 1 to 99, there were 170 in the experiment, they had a defection of 26%. Churches with a communicant membership of 100 to 299, and the bulk of them came out of this group, 671, and they had a defection of 18. And so it goes on until you have churches with communicant membership of 1,000 or more, 61 were in the experiment, 15%. So it goes from 26 from the very small congregation to 15 to the large. Now, I don't know whether you can see one variable which was missing. If you merely take these figures as such, just size, let me give you this little picture. These are some of the comments. The error which is in the whole study is right there in the figure, but the man who did the study didn't see it. While the general defection average is 17%, there is a wide range among the various districts from a low 10% to a high of 32%. The highest rates of defection were reported from California, Nevada District, 32%, Southern California, 29%, Atlantic, 28%, Northwest, 27%, Florida and Georgia, 24%. You see anything that's significant or common about these?
Whether it's an urban or a rural.
That's one, yes. Yeah, these are mission congregations, mostly, mission districts, which means they don't have a backlog of one, two, three generations. And being urban, of course, where things are still more, that's another factor, an important one. Because he says, significantly, these same districts all report a high percentage of non-Lutheran children confirmed, ranging from 23 to 41%. And he doesn't even see the variable after he gives you the information why he's wrong. Because he didn't believe he was wrong, understand? And then you have the cases of others where the high rates were Oklahoma, Southern Illinois, Kansas, Southern Nebraska, Texas, Central Illinois, and there they range from 8 to 11%. Well, these are the ones which at that time particularly, and this is not the picture changed particularly in Oklahoma and Texas, but these were stable, where there was very little proportionate influx of new members. It's the hidden factor of the home.
Well, wouldn't the percentage be affected, too, by, for example, if you had one person defecting in a small congregation and one person defecting from a large congregation,
this part of it.
This
is always a bad thing. Never add percentages and don't compare percentages unless your base is reasonably the same. Now, there are a number of statistics. This is a very poor statistical job, but it made headlines. But these are the things that can trap you in your own thesis. Not only look what he did, you have to look at look what I may be doing with the data. That's all I'm really interested in. Yes, sir?
Yeah, well,
yeah.
Nothing over about maybe one now, but I don't know, California.
Yeah. This is a regional problem, it's a mission problem, it's urban-rural problem, all of these are the factors. But I would think the most important one is that these are newly confirmed. And anyone who has been a pastor in a congregation with a large percentage of adult accessions and children who have, see, you confirm the adult and he has a 14-year-old youngster and you win him over too at the same time, chances are you will, or particularly if it's a 10-year-old youngster, but he's been for 10 years in, theoretically, in a non-Christian atmosphere. Now, that may not be correct, because he might have been a Baptist or a Methodist or a Roman Catholic, but chances are that often the years preceding to the switch, there has been a decline. That's why they're switching. You win them over. That's not true, of course, when it's a marital conversion, so to speak, but then the children are not involved in a situation like that. And so you may win the adults, but you don't necessarily change the attitudes that have already been inculcated. And so a pastor who deals with a lot of novices always has a larger percentage of defection. And this is particularly true if he wins the child and never gets the home. As another factor where an unusually large number of children will be lost. Well, again, it's to emphasize the fact that we have to be sure that our data satisfies the conditions of the problem. And then a well-known one, of course, which you're always warned against, the so-called reasoning from silence. And I suppose one of the major traditions, not held so much today anymore, but was almost necessary to be a good Lutheran, was to say that Peter was never in Rome. The argument usually is out of silence because it wasn't mentioned in Romans, the last chapter of Romans. But data today, while it's not much more valid, it is still more valid than that argument from silence. Well, that's in a general way. Then there's the individual dealing, such things as the external criticism, doesn't usually play too much a part, namely, is the document that you've got a genuine one? What does the document tell you about the author and the textual criticism like? That's more valid in history and in exegesis. And then the so-called higher criticism, the internal evidence, is the authority whom you are quoting in a position to know. In the book, which is quite popular at one time in our circles, by Dahlman, How Peter Became Pope, some of the quotations as proofs for some of the things that were done in those days. The man lived 150 years after the event. Well, he's not much more of an evidence than you and I are to the shooting of McKinley. We're even closer than that. I don't think anybody would want to take us as prime witnesses. Is the authority competent? This is another thing. When you take archaeology, you're sure that you're going to take men like Glick and Albright and Breasted and these men rather than some hack who is writing archaeological articles for the Sunday paper. An opinion of a noted scholar unsupported by fact is still an opinion. Let's not forget that. Then is the authority trustworthy in terms of his own biases? That's why I said before, be sure to look at the prefaces to see whether, what the man, man's point of view is to begin with. Again, sometimes the evidence of, well, this man is a good Roman Catholic, but look what he says about the Pope. Until you remember that, especially in the 18th century, there was a much animosity between the various parties, especially in Italy. If you were Florentine or a Venetian or whether you came from the Papal States, you're all Roman Catholics, but after all, you're not a member of the Papal State. And we just like today, we say, well, Truman is an American citizen, good, loyal citizen, and Goldwater is a good, loyal American, and now what they either say about the other's party must be valid. Certainly important to find out who's talking for what. So don't get caught in that dilemma and simply say, well, this fellow's a Roman Catholic or he's a Lutheran, therefore his what he says for good or bad about his own church body is must be reliable. Now, we wouldn't do this about our own because we have a closer perspective, unless we wanted the argument pretty badly, and so we used it. But we are more likely to do it when we cite another one. Or age is a factor. Is the fellow really sure he was a witness of the event, but does he still remember it correctly? Old people's recollections are notoriously fallible. Even an eyewitness, you know, coming fresh from the scene, may not have seen what actually happened, because an untrained person may mistake hearsay for fact. A prejudiced mind will be reflected in the comments on his comments concerning the events. Can the authority be substantiated? Sometimes you only have one authority because only one person has written on it. Tacitus, Suetonius are authorities which we accept today. No, because there's nothing better available. It may be well to warn you against accepting traditions as historical facts. One of the more common ones in the Lutheran Church, which I know all of you are well aware of, the words that Luther was supposed to have said at Worms, "Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, God help me, amen," has absolutely no contemporary proof to it. I think the first time it was actually ever mentioned was at least 100 years later. And if you think of it, and it's a good quote, what he did certainly represents the quote. But what he said, everybody could have seen without it. They knew he was standing there. He certainly didn't do anything else. And whatever he did in God's name. So it's a nice dramatic thing, but we have very little proof for it, whether he ever said it. Now, that's not important, I realize. And I'm using these things because they're harmless, rather than